Hello and welcome to The Wire, where you can rely on independent news and current affairs on your local community radio station, wherever you are around Australia. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
The core driver of the unrest we saw last week is going to take a lot of work to fix, and it's rooted in these long-held economic problems that you have in Solomon Islands.
There was more unrest in the Solomon Islands on the weekend, with a number of people killed in rioting in the capital Honiara. Australia has sent a patrol boat, HMAS Armidale, to support 66 Defence Force officers and 70 Australian Federal Police were there to reinforce stretched Solomon Island police. Foreign Minister Maurice Payne says all Australian citizens are safe and the situation does appear to be calmer today. Also on the program...
If we had a corruption body, maybe it would never have got that far.
With a federal government member crossing the floor last week to vote for an independence anti-corruption body bill, Prime Minister Scott Morrison is going to need crossbench support to get his own version of ICAC through the House of Representatives. We find out what independent Bob Catter wants to do. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. But first, an atmosphere of uncertainty has emerged all over the world as new cases of the Omicron variant continue to be identified in countries such as Hong Kong, Israel, the UK and now Australia. While scientists have warned that it may take a number of weeks to fully understand the threat of this new COVID-19 strain poses, the international response has varied from countries closing their borders to some reintroducing stronger public health measures. In Australia, there is a growing sense of concern about how the strain may once again affect daily lives. Evan Wallace took to the streets of Melbourne to see how residents in the city, which holds the record for the longest period in a COVID-19 lockdown, were responding to the new variant.
It's Monday lunchtime in the northeast suburb of Fairfield in Melbourne, and despite a few noticeable exceptions, with people wearing face masks walking up and down the street, you couldn't tell that this suburb has spent the last number of months in lockdown and many months in 2020. And despite the buzz, the traffic, the shopping, there's an air of uncertainty as people respond to the first cases of the Omicron strand in Australia. I spoke with Fairfield shopping goers in Station Street about how they were feeling around the new variant and what response they'd like to see governments pursue. How are you feeling about the Omicron variant?
I don't think it's that bad until we find out.
And given that uncertainty, what sort of response would you like governments to pursue?
Just doing what they're doing, I guess. But I think that there's just got to be... You got to do all that sort of stuff for a while yet. Wear masks and keep your distance.
I don't know yet about what will happen or what we do. Yeah, so I don't know yet.
And while for some shoppers the Omicron variant throws up a real sense of uncertainty, for others such as Anastasia, it sends them back to a period of time that they'd rather forget.
The other day.
You were shocked the other day?
I was shocked the other day because my daughter's boss rang her and she said, you know, it's a new variant coming. Mm-hmm. And the name is Omicron. I thought, they after our Greek letters. Delta, Omicron. So I believe it's not bad like the other one. I'm confused. I don't know what to believe anymore. I don't want this lockdown again. I am sick of it because we all suffer from mentally and physically. See, all through the lockdown, we get together here just to talk a little bit with the masks and everything. Lucky we haven't got a mask now. But I'm confused. This is keep coming, isn't it? Keep coming and coming. It's going to come more after the Omicron? I don't know.
That's what scientists say, that there will continue to be new variants, so it's likely to be something that continues.
We hear so many stories. I was talking to some friend of ours, and they say, you don't know what's in these injections are, what are chemicals they got, and there's people suffering from kidney problem, liver problems. Is it true? I'm double vaxxed and I start to worry now. I don't know.
Fairfield shopper Anastasia there. And finally, for people such as Gabby, there's a real sense of doubt about how the future's going to play out.
What's the next one? Omicron, Sigma, Tau, you know, there's going to be new ones all the time. We've just got to obviously be aware. We've got to be able to manage it. And I'm just really mindful, and I'm really worried, like I said, for my little one and what their future holds down the track, because I don't know what's going to happen for their future. I don't know. And I'm worried for them. I'm worried. Look, they need to have a future. Okay, the elderly, they've had their time, but you worry about them, but I worry for the little ones.
With such significant uncertainty about the risk that the Omicron strand presents, I spoke with Professor Mary Louise McClaws, Professor of Epidemiology at the University of New South Wales, for her take on the emerging situation. With that significant level of uncertainty and complexity that's there, how satisfied are you with the Australian federal government's initial response?
Well, I was very pleased that they took this seriously, because in March last year, when we just closed to China, we got virus in through other countries. So I'd like to see them have the same approach to anyone coming in for the next couple of weeks until we find out exactly how far this virus has moved around the world and how transmissible it is, and whether or not it will cause more death, because, you know, our elderly haven't yet been fully given their booster shot, because they'll be the ones that will be at risk at the moment, because their antibodies will be waning after they received their vaccine earlier in this year in March, April.
I was speaking to a number of shoppers in one of Melbourne's suburbs today, a city that's experienced the world's longest period of lockdown, and I would say about one out of two shoppers that I spoke with were really concerned about the prospect of additional lockdowns. Are you concerned that additional lockdowns may be required in different cities within Australia?
No, I'm not concerned, because as the government has prevented the nine countries from allowing anybody in, but mind you, there are about another 13 countries or so that either have had Omicron or have probable cases. I do think that they need to ensure that everybody turning up from anywhere is tested, and is tested on day one and at least day four and five. But I can't see us needing a lockdown yet, because, you know, Australia has responded brilliantly and been vaccinated. However, there's a group that still need more time or more effort to get vaccinated. And they're the young, who were offered the vaccine only from mid-September.
Professor Mary Louise McClaws there, Professor of Epidemiology, Healthcare, Infection and Infectious Diseases Control at the University of New South Wales, ending that report from Evan Wallace.
Whenever I want to catch up with current affairs in Australia, I head to thewire.org.au, or I follow them on Twitter. I just search for The Wire Radio, all one word. And yes, they're on Facebook too.
The federal government is on the path to stopping online trolls in a crackdown set to make people think twice before posting. The proposed changes are likely to require social media companies to mandate a user's name, email address, and phone number in order to quickly identify a person deemed to be producing harmful content. Scott Morrison stated that the rules that exist in the real world must exist in the digital and online world, and he's drafted legislation set to be released this week. Mark DiPoli has this story.
It appears simple, and it is. The way to stop faceless trolls behind the screen is to put a face on them. The Morrison government looks set to empower the courts with the ability to force social media companies to hand over the identities of users in defamation cases. It will provide greater protection for those in positions of high scrutiny, like politicians, but have an equally important impact on cyberbullying amidst Australia's youth. According to Ali Halkich, co-founder and operations manager of Bully Zero, online abuse has been a neglected issue for far too long.
To give you an insight, that 450 children committed suicide in 2018, which is a whole school that disappears over, you know, out of Australia each year, and yet nobody seems to raise the concerns and issues. So what's happening at the moment with this legislation, if it gets up, and the big issue is here, is that They're talking about it, but how long it's going to take to put into effect is the unknown.
Hal Kitch tragically lost his son in 2009, a victim of cyberbullying. It has been his mission, along with many other affected parents, to ensure no child is ever made to feel like there is no other option. He sees the prospective changes as a huge step forwards.
Make people accountable and responsible for what they post and put online. It's a no-brainer from my end, and I truly believe it would save lives down the track, definitely.
However, these changes are still in the planning stage. According to Jason Bosland, an associate professor at the Melbourne Law School at the University of Melbourne, there are still several issues that need to be ironed out.
Media companies were liable as publishers of third-party comments that were posted in response to articles that they had posted on their own Facebook pages. And so that ruling is seen as being particularly harsh and could lead to sort of, you know, unfairness, I suppose, in terms of who might be subject to that rule. And so that case was decided in the context of mainstream media organisations posting things on Facebook and then being liable for third-party comments. But potentially that ruling could extend to others who use social media. So, for example, individuals could potentially be liable for third-party comments that have been posted on their own Facebook pages. And part of the proposed reforms would be to address that.
With the intention being to aid defamation cases, social media users who aim to spread unfairly hateful comments will have to do so knowing that their name is instantly traceable.
That would require that the platforms know who the end users are. And essentially what will happen is that once the platform discloses the identity to a person who makes a complaint to them, in response to something that's been published about them, for example, then the platforms will no longer be considered to be publishers. It's very easy to publish online anonymously, and there's considered to be an essential lack of fairness, I suppose, when people go online, they post anonymously, and they defame people in the course of doing that.
With instances of cyberbullying, the changes will more likely stop youth from creating fake accounts that target an individual, which Hal Kitch believes will stop a large part of the issue at its source.
It's been evident that during even this COVID period that the amount of people or kids that have been home online, 40% increase on online bullying has been reported, and that's the ones that have been reported, with families concerned of the trolls and the online harassment. I think it's only going to, you know, become a bigger issue down the track, so I can reassure you, if that was in line when my son was alive, you know, the possibilities is he could have been with us alive today.
Social media is a place where legitimate criticism can occur, whether it is of a sporting team or politician. For all its good, will the Morrison government's proposed changes provide those in the public eye an unfair layer of protection? Associate Professor Bosland suggests that this will solve defamation claims quicker, but the government should still consider the grey areas first.
Now, a lot of people make the claim that, well, if you're going to criticise someone, you should do it under your own name. But there might be all sorts of reasons why people who engage in social media might want to do so anonymously. For example, they may work within a government department and the minister that's in charge of that department might be doing something and they might want to comment on it. But to do so under their own name potentially would lead to ramifications in terms of their employment. So there are reasons why we don't want to completely prevent people from posting anonymously, but these reforms will certainly have the effect of making it easier for politicians to be able to identify those who have criticised them online and then bring proceedings against them.
Associate Professor Jason Bosland from the Melbourne Law School at the University of Melbourne, ending that story by Mark DePolly.
Hi, it's Costa here from Gardening Australia, and I absolutely love listening to The Wire.
As Parliament enters one of its last sitting weeks of the year, the Morrison government is under pressure to deliver on a federal corruption body it promised 3 years ago. Prime Minister Scott Morrison has said that his government will advance with a much-criticised model for a federal anti-corruption commission if Labor supports it. Comes after federal backbencher Bridget Archer crossed the floor last Thursday to vote against the government for a stronger proposal put forward by independent member Helen Haynes. Talia Kreft asked Bob Catter, crossbencher and federal member for Kennedy, if he supports the federal government's current model for an anti-corruption commission.
I have backed
the crossbenchers proposal, which is a little bit stronger than the government's proposal. But I want to warn people here, myself and Bill Gunn, the Deputy Premier of Queensland, was a senior minister in the government. We made the decision to call on the inquiry, the Fitzgerald inquiry. Now, in Queensland, there were 42 murders attributable to a group of policemen. And there's no way that we could yard them. I tried to do it by myself and expose. And looking back on it, I suppose ex-Commissioner of Police Ray Whitrod said he went in fear of his life. Well, I went in fear of put in jail on trumped-up charges. I think some 20 police officers, who were the good guys, that were trying desperately to stop what was going on in Queensland. And when I say 42, 22 of those were the infamous Whiskey A Go-Go, where 22 people were burnt to death. It was a firebombing over the payment of corrupt, making of corrupt payments that weren't made, and the doors locked. If we had a corruption body, maybe it would never have got that far. Maybe it would have. Maybe it wouldn't have. But I had nobody to go to. I just had to do my own thing. There was an ALP member opened his mouth, made one statement, and then wet his pants. But the Commissioner of Police for Queensland retired, or sacked, whatever. He said he went in fear of his life. I said I went in fear of incarceration. Looking back on it, it probably would have been more true to say I should have been in fear of my life. But 20 totally terrific, courageous anti-corruption police, they had child pornography put on their computers. And later in the inquiry, it didn't work. But early in the inquiry, it did. And these people had their lives completely ruined.
What do you make of the move by government backbencher Bridget Archer last week, who crossed the floor to bring on parliamentary debate over a stronger model which Helen Haynes had proposed?
Look, I think it is very, very rare for anyone to cross the floor, and it takes an enormous amount of courage to do that. We would get much better government if that was done more often. When I was in the party, I crossed the floor a number of times. I won't say many times, a number of times, on very crucial issues. But you are hounded and bullied. If you got bullied at school, you would understand what happens to you if you do that. You are no longer one of the in crowd. You're very much one of the out crowd. And really, I think your political death is not far away if you do that.
The government has signalled the bill will only come into Parliament for a federal anti-corruption commission if Labor supports the bill. Are you confident Labor will back this bill?
Well, I mean, you know, Labor were there for 6 years. They didn't do anything on anti-corruption. I mean, their activities in New South Wales would be the hallmark and underlining bottom line for corruption in this country. I mean, there are numerous books pointing out Labor's activity in New South Wales. And, of course, New South Wales dominates the Labor Party. I don't think they're particularly keen on this inquiry. They might say they are, but, well, they were there. They didn't do anything about it. And they're under pressure to do something about it from people like Andrew Wilkie, a very enviable reputation for fighting crime and corruption.
What do you make of Scott Morrison's rejecting of the New South Wales model of ICAC? He said it was a kangaroo court that had done over former Premier Gladys Berejiklian.
Yeah, I think it's a valid call. I mean, I think the activities in Queensland and New South Wales, which I'm familiar with, absolutely a kangaroo court. No question about that. But then again, what happened in Queensland is proof positive that even if it is a kangaroo court, I think you need something. I mean, I'm agonised about it, and I've come down the side of Helen Haynes. But, you know, I mean, the alternative is to keep going the way you're going. And I think that the number of corrupt murders in New South Wales are all a matter of public record. I think it was McGurk said he was going to expose the land deals in the ALP government in New South Wales, and he was shot dead 9 days later. I took a bet with a bloke that he'd be dead in 2 months. I was wrong. He was shot dead 9 days, I think it was. He was shot dead. And as far as I remember, no one even went to court over it.
Just finally, Mr. Cutter, do you think you will get a vaccine so you can head back to the pub?
Good question. A very good question. No, I'm vaccinated. In fact, my vaccination, I'm the only person that was on national television, only politician that was on national television being vaccinated. No, I've told people to take the advice of their doctors, which almost invariably is to get the vaccine. And no, we're not anti-vaccine. We're anti-compulsion. But no, I didn't have that bit of paper with me, or at least I couldn't find it. But I had my identification so they could ring up and confirm with Parliament I had my COVID vaccination.
Federal Member for Kennedy, Bob Catter, speaking there with Talia Kreft. The deployment of Australian Defence Force troops to the Solomon Islands last week by the Prime Minister has appeared to have some effect in slowing the riots that saw civilians killed and buildings burnt down in the capital Honiara. This unrest has come about partly due to the Solomon Islands Prime Minister, Manasseh Tsirgavare, ending diplomatic ties with Taiwan and establishing links with China. James Murray asked Director of the McHale Institute, Edward Kavanagh, whom he thinks is currently exerting the most influence over the Solomon Islands.
Yeah, I think that there is a bit of a concern by some in Solomon Islands that there's this sort of meddling going on by actors like Taiwan, like the United States, because of the China switch that occurred in 2019 with the Manasseh Tsirgavare government further aligning itself to China instead of Taiwan. I think what Tsirgavare was saying with that point, however, was really, you know, he was kind of playing the internal politics as well. The reality is what we've actually seen is not so much foreign powers meddling in Malaita, but Malaita itself courting foreign powers to play the internal game of politics within Solomon Islands. So the Premier of Malaita himself, Daniel Sedani, has been very deft at engaging Taiwan, engaging the United States, and eliciting concessions from those parties because they see advantage in having this sort of Taiwan-aligned province within Solomon Islands. So Manasseh Tsirgavare is correct broadly in saying there has been some degree of international influence making, but a lot of the origination behind that has actually come from the Malaitans themselves. When we're talking about the national government in Solomon Islands, they recognised China diplomatically in 2019, which was certainly controversial. It's a big decision, but it is in reality effectively the same position that almost the entire rest of the world has. I mean, their policy regarding China now is exactly the same as Australia's or New Zealand's or the United States. So in that sense, what they've done is not particularly remarkable.
Do you think what is happening in the Solomon Islands will take place in other islands in the South Pacific?
Well, I think that there's some very unique features to this current unrest in Solomon Islands that's unique to the country itself. And what we saw play out last week with the violence on the streets of Honiara really was the culmination of several years of tensions, but actually these tensions go back decades, even longer. The Malaitans, which were effectively the instigators of this unrest, they have long held and legitimate economic and cultural grievances with central rule in Honiara. And it really dates back to the fact that, you know, the Malaitans really struggling. There are huge economic problems in Solomon Islands. The island of Malaita itself is incredibly impoverished, only has about 3% of the population with electricity, for example. So there are some real reasons why the Malaitans grieve with the state of development within that country. It's unlikely that you'd see similar type of unrest in any other Pacific country in the near future, simply because there's not the same sort of internal dynamics as you have in Solomon Islands, which is one of the most complicated and one of the largest countries in the Pacific.
How effective do you think the Australian Defence Force will be with their presence in the Solomon Islands?
The ADF deployment is really important. I think it was a necessary step. I mean, Australia was treaty-bound at the request of Tsirgavare government to actually come to the assistance of Solomon Islands, but the deployment is limited, it's small. I think it sets more of a signal than actually doing a huge amount of practical defence work. I know, you know, the initial deployment was only 23 people on Thursday night, I think it was, and that did at least something to just settle down and send a signal to the looters that, you know, the behaviour had to slow down. So Australia's deployment is a really important part of it, and we're now seeing similar deployments coming from New Zealand, Fiji and Papua New Guinea.
Is an internal solution possible for those in the Solomon Islands, or will they have to continue to rely on external support?
The core driver of the unrest we saw last week is going to take a lot of work to fix, and it's rooted in the long-held economic problems that you have in Solomon Islands. And, you know, without major development assistance that's equitable, that brings people along, that unifies these two different factions within the country, we're going to see future generations of Malaitans have the same sort of grievances that the current ones do and like previous ones have. So you can't really flip a switch and fix this problem. This is a dynamic that is sort of unique to the nature of the country, but it could get worse without really an expedited amount of development assistance from Australia and others, because COVID has absolutely decimated Solomon Islands' economy. And it's just compounded the problem. So, you look, it's a worrying trend and dynamic in Solomon Islands that I think requires internal solutions, but with that sort of financial support from their international partners too.
Director of the McHale Institute, Edward Kavanagh, speaking there with James Murray. And that's all we have for you on The Wire today. Find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.